a lot of people said to me, like, how could you spend, 2 years building up this company and making all this money and like having this team and then just walking away from it? I was like, because I'm not the company. I am me, and I'm going to do something else. That idea of non-attachment, I think, is so important. And I don't mean to the extent where people can be like flaky and just like not fulfill responsibilities. You are not your ideas, right? And you are not the company. As much as a company might be your baby, like if you hold on to a sinking ship, that's not going to serve anybody. So at the end of the day, you need to be able to walk away from things. You need to be able to burn things to the ground in order to build up the right thing.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This week's guest on Famous Failures is Ari Mizell. Ari is a best-selling author, productivity expert, CEO, real estate developer, and a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School of Business. Several years ago, Ari encountered and ultimately overcame severe personal roadblocks, and that journey transformed his life. His discoveries and personal and professional productivity have improved the lives of thousands of individuals and businesses. His proprietary process, which is called the Less Doing System, is the foundation of his company, Less Doing, which offers individuals and enterprises road-tested methods to optimize, automate, and outsource everything. You can join Less Doing Labs for free on Facebook or visit lessdoing.com to learn how to work smarter instead of harder. In the interview, Ari discusses how he hit rock bottom at age 23 when he found himself $3 million in debt and diagnosed with Crohn's disease. He explains the strategies that he used to turn his life around. He went on to compete in the French Ironman competition, which is pretty incredible, and go on to launch his brand, Less Doing. He also discusses his recent departure from the virtual assistant company that he had founded and the lessons that he learned from that business breakup, which are exceedingly valuable for all aspiring entrepreneurs. As always, if you've been enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to subscribe to it on iTunes or Google Play. And if you're feeling extra generous, please leave a rating and a review. That goes a really long way in alerting others to the podcast. And if you'd like to keep in touch with me, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Contrarian, and also get my free ebook, The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking, doing one of two things. One would be to go to my website, ozanvarol.com, O-Z-A-N-V-A-R-O-L, V-A-S-M-Victor.com, and just input your email address. Or you can text my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345, and we will send over that ebook right out to you. You'll also get my weekly newsletter, which will land in your inbox every Thursday. It's really short. It just shares with you an article that I wrote that week, any books I've read, and other tools to help change the way that you look at the world. Without further ado, I give you Ari Mizell. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. And as always, thank you for listening. Ari, welcome to Famous Failures.
Thanks, Ozan. It's always nice to talk to you.
Yeah, we've known each other for some time now, but I've discovered new tidbits of information about you as I was doing the research for this interview. So I want to wind the clock back to your teenage years, because one of the things I read, and feel free to correct the record on this one, since what I found on the internet may be unreliable, but you started several companies as a teenager. So when you were 12 years old, you had a website design company. I guess one question is, correct me if I'm wrong about that, but if that is right, I want to ask what you attribute that entrepreneurial drive and courage to, especially at such a young age. And the reason I'm asking about that is this theme of moving quickly from idea to execution, which is actually the title of one of your books, has been a pretty constant theme in your life. And it sounds like it dates back to when you were 12. So how did it all get started?
If I want to talk about it from like a psychological background, I would have to say that there was a statistic that I read a long time ago that seemed to be very apt, which was that a very, very large percentage of young entrepreneurs, so entrepreneurs who were entrepreneurs before they were 18, basically, came from homes where the mother was overbearing and the father was physically or emotionally absent. And so that definitely describes my childhood. My mother is like a typical Jewish mother, so everything I did was genius and amazing, which by the time I was 11, I knew that didn't really mean anything. And my father was completely emotionally absent. So what I think that led to is this sort of like innate desire to keep sort of proving myself and, pushing for something to get noticed. The other problem, well, it's sort of double-edged sword with that, is that I never really had a lot of my ideas challenged. So even as an adult, that's something that I still have to sort of deal with, where I tend to, my natural reaction is to get defensive in some cases when I should be learning from the experience. So all that to say, that kind of like makes for a perfect sort of entrepreneurial hot pot where you can just grab an opportunity and go with it. And in the case of the website design company, this is like 23 years ago, I guess now, and HTML was not the newest thing, but it, you know, a lot of kids were like sort of tinkering with it. And I'd made some websites, and somebody saw one of the websites I'd made and said, "Oh, could you make one for me? I'll pay you $500." I was like, "Yeah, sure, I can." That was how it started. You know, it just sort of got thrown into it. So then all of a sudden, you know, after I did that one, now I had a website design firm, and now I was offering my services. You know, and it's like one day it wasn't, and then the next day it was. And I think I've always been sort of a chameleon in that way, a little bit, where I could shift to the situation. If you look at Colby, my Colby profile, I'm a high quick start. And the description of my profile is that I will say yes before I hear the end of the question and then turn it into a productive journey. And I think that's a pretty good descriptor of my life.
That's amazing. And I think that probably accurately describes what happened after you graduated from college as well. One of the things that struck me as really interesting is that you got a C+ in your real estate development course, and then went on to found a real estate and construction business. So tell us about that journey a little bit, because, you know, if a student gets a C+ in one of the classes that I teach as a law professor, the usual reaction is, "I want nothing to do with the subject matter." So how did you end up going from C+ in real estate development to actually starting a real estate and construction business?
Well, so there's two things there. One, I would say, is that, as you're probably aware, a lot of people end up in a lot of careers that don't actually have anything to do with their degree, right? You were a rocket scientist and now you're a law professor. A real estate development education at an Ivy League school, because I went to Wharton, has nothing to do with what it takes to build a building. So I was always fascinated by construction. And when I got out of college, I went up to upstate New York. Well, actually, so I worked for an alumni for, I think, 4 or 5 months, which was short-lived because I'm fairly unemployable. And that was a very traditional sort of real estate development role. I was basically an analyst. So I'm looking at spreadsheets instead of bricks, you know, and moving numbers around instead of pallets. When I went a few months later to visit a friend in upstate New York, I saw these old buildings that were from the 1860s. And it reminded me of home. I'd grown up in this old loft building in New York City. I was like, I think I can build lofts here. I don't know how to do it. Again, an Ivy League real estate development education doesn't teach you how to build anything. So I sort of learned on the job. And the deal was that anybody that worked on the job had to teach me their trade. So I spent the next 3 years learning and doing every construction trade imaginable. Through that process, which I'm sure we're going to get to this, I wouldn't call that whole experience a success by any means, but I did learn project management, how to lead a team, the finances, the actual construction, the politics, the legal aspects, zoning, marketing, everything. It was like a PhD in actual real estate development. Whereas the things that I got C pluses on were the much more sterile test tube versions, and is the best way to put it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's always a disconnect between the theory in the classroom and then the practical realities, which is certainly true for law school as well. But it sounds like in real estate, that gap is particularly wide. So you mentioned, Ari, that the construction and real estate business didn't necessarily end up, or you wouldn't characterize it as a success. Why do you say that?
I didn't know what I was doing, right? And, I mean, and I learned along the way. There were a lot of hiccups along the way. Some of them were just like structural construction issues that we had to take down an entire wall of a 4-story building that we had not planned on doing and didn't have to do it in the middle of the winter, which made the cost enormously higher because we were heating it with like jet engines all day long. But I blew through $1.5 million credit line pretty quickly and then had to get another one. So by the time I was 23, I was in $3 million of debt. And I was under the impression, I believe, that this community was ready for this kind of loft development. And the thing is that I wasn't doing anything that innovative. The loft development is something that's happened hundreds of times around the world. And there's sort of very specific characteristics that come into play when you see these kind of loft developments. So artists start to move in to spaces that are not necessarily that great or that livable, and they start to fix it up. And then some retail starts to come in, and then the prices go up. And it's very formulaic. And in hindsight, I was a little early. I was probably 5 to 7 years early, which makes sense since it took about 5 to 7 years to finally completely sell out the project, whereas I think in other circumstances, it might have taken one. So I ended up making quite a bit less, carrying a lot more debt for a lot longer, stressing myself beyond belief, and not necessarily a direct result, but I think a pretty direct result. When I was 23, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease. The stress and the way I'd been treating my body had just become too much. I was broken in a lot of different ways.
For the members of the audience who've never heard of Crohn's disease before, could you briefly describe what that is?
Sure. So Crohn's is a chronic inflammatory condition that affects the digestive tract. It's very, very, very painful. And back then, it was not particularly well understood. It's still sort of an enigma for many, and it is considered to be incurable. And it's just very debilitating. So I went from working these like 18-hour days to barely being able to do an hour of work a day.
It sounds like you hit rock bottom at 23. So you're $3 million in debt. You've got Crohn's disease. How did you turn your life around?
So it also happened to coincide with, so I got diagnosed a month after I started a relationship with my now wife, Anna, which is obviously, that's a good thing. But adding in a relationship to everything else was going on in itself was not a good thing. Right. So there was just so much happening. But in the end, I mean, it was really my wife and her support and guidance to some extent to help me figure out how to overcome the illness. Now, I was on some pretty hardcore medicine, which a lot of people end up staying on for the rest of their life. I was on it for a fairly short amount of time. And I do credit it with giving me a little bit of a break to try to figure this out. The problem with many chronic conditions where people get on meds is that they don't change their lifestyle. So the medicine eventually stops working. I took an opportunity after a really, really bad night in the hospital where I thought that was going to be it, that I had to do something different. So I began this journey of self-tracking and self-experimentation and looking at the data that had been collected in my blood tests and every other imaginable test that had been done on me. And that control became my antidote to stress. And as I started to get better, I started to get better and better, and there was momentum there. I started training for Ironman France, which is something that I couldn't even fathom at the time because I was so weak. And because I had such limited time to work or to get things done, and I still had this project in Binghamton to sell, I began to hack productivity methods. And I was always into sort of building and construction and fixing things and remashing things up together. But this time I figured out ways to get more done in less time. And it was out of necessity. And so that was where the whole system of productivity of less doing was born, which began as a blog and then grew into some best-selling books to teaching, seminars, speaking around the world, and now full-on coaching programs and business consulting.
That's amazing. So I want to go back to the Ironman. You have this debilitating, seemingly incurable disease. I think most people in your position would say, well, I'll do whatever I can to get better. But you decided to do Ironman France. Now, most people would find that crazy, I think. So walk us through your, you know, mental, your thought process. So what prompted you to do that?
Of course, it wasn't like, oh, I woke up one day and I was like, let's do Ironman. I was actually quite resistant to the idea. So while I was getting better and learning more about my body and about the data and everything, I wanted to increase my knowledge. So my wife was the yoga instructor, so I started my yoga teacher training because just anatomy and movement and all that stuff I thought would be helpful. And then I started becoming certified as an EMT, so an emergency medical technician. And while I was doing that, I met a guy named Jonathan who we became friendly, and he's older and he had done a few triathlons, not Ironman. And he was saying, he's like, you know, you should do a triathlon. And I was like, no, I can't, you know, like, I don't know how I could do that. And he's like, no, the Olympic ones are not so bad. Like, we can train together. I was like, okay, great. So like 3 months later, we did the Mighty Montauk Olympic distance triathlon, which took about 2.5 hours to complete it. I finished it. I didn't finish it like feeling amazing, but I finished it. And it was like, great. Okay. So I kept sort of training. I did Tough Mudder and civilian military combine and other, all sorts of like things like that were these sort of physical tests. But then I was teaching a cardio class. So my wife ran a yoga studio, which she created and was running. And I started teaching this cardio class, and I was just getting in better and better shape. And this guy came to the class with a friend of mine, and he was training for Ironman. And so after the class, he came up to me. He's like, hey, that was a great class. Have you ever considered, you know, going for Ironman? And I was like, no way in hell would I ever want to do Ironman. You're crazy. No thanks. And not 2 hours later, I came to my room and I went to check my email, and I had a message from my friend Jonathan. And he was like, Ironman France next June, are you in? And I wrote back, Yes. My wife is French. Her whole family's there. It was going to be in Nice, where a lot of her family is. And it was like a year and 2 months or so later. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. So started training and got up to like 20, 25 hours a week of training for Ironman while creating all this content for Less Doing and writing the book. And I had a path. Like that's a big thing for me, is that the only failure for me is if you don't learn something. And I was starting to really learn and apply and share. And I felt motivated again for the first time in a long time.
And then you built this just amazing brand, Less Doing, which you recently revived. If we can go back to the beginnings of Less Doing and thinking through how you grew the brand from scratch, what were some of the maybe one or two of the most valuable failures you had along the way?
The most valuable failures in Less Doing, well... I think that, so I started out as a blog, and I started with a friend actually named Jameson. About a month or two after we started writing, he went off to start a company called Launch Rock, which he's done very well with. I think that I was treating it a little bit too much like a hobby for a long time, and I wasn't polishing my material enough. That's the first thing. So what I mean by that is, like, I would just put things out there sometimes and see how people responded to them, and sometimes people responded really well and sometimes they didn't. And I don't think that I, like, nowadays I'm really, really good about pulling in that kind of feedback and closing that loop. But back then I think I was a little bit more like, no, this is the way it should be. And probably almost like a little bit cocky about it, which I didn't really have the right to be. So this is a funny one. Once I've sort of built up a lot of the content, I started teaching classes, and there was a platform called Skillshare at the time. And I was it was my fifth or sixth class. And at the end, this guy walks out to me and he says, you know, that was great. Do you do private coaching? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And it's $249 a month. And we meet twice a month and you can call me in between. Now, I made that up on the spot. And I wasn't coaching. I don't know why I came up with that pricing like that. But he said yes. And so then I started coaching, and I'd never coached before. And I just was sort of sharing, and I was listening and sharing the knowledge that I had. Nothing like really grave happened, but there were several sessions with certain clients where I definitely went into territory that it was not appropriate for me. And I was more like a therapist in that situation, which I'm not qualified to be. I found myself in situations that I was not comfortable with, and I was potentially not giving sound advice either, but it was a learning experience. I got to figure out how to really hone what my material was and what kind of offering I was doing. The worst thing that happened with that was that I started to actually sell my coaching. So when I would do these seminars, I'd say at the end, hey, and by the way, I offer private coaching, which was great because every single class I'd start to pick up one or two clients. But I got into a couple situations where people would ask me, like, what kind of people do you coach? And I would always sort of make up like an amalgamation of different traits of different clients, because I was trying to, you know, act like I was protecting people's privacy, which I should be. But I would make up people based on real people. And one time I did that, and somebody in the class happened to just like know who I was talking about. And I ended up revealing something that was related to her employment that ended up, again, it didn't become a terrible thing, but it could have been a very, very bad situation for me. So learning on the go was a big theme for me.
And then eventually you decided to transition, I don't want to say out of Less Doing, because you certainly remained in that effectiveness space, but to co-found a virtual assistant company. What prompted you to pivot?
Yeah. So, you know, it's another kind of one of those situations where it's just like I'm able to switch very quickly and sort of go with the flow. And I think that in and of itself is a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing if you're not really sort of controlling that or putting that in within the right parameters. So all that to say, I was having dinner with a friend at the time, Nick, that morning. It just happened that morning, this very, very large virtual assistant company called Zirtual had gone out of business. So at the time, I was running Less Doing. I was running a mastermind coaching program with several people, and it was doing well. I wasn't doing like incredibly, but it was doing really well. My wife and I had three kids. She was pregnant with our fourth. And we had dinner that night, and we're talking about what had happened with Zirtual and what we would have done differently and how we would run a VA company. Both of us had a lot of experience in the space. And Nick said to me, why don't you just start your own VA company? And I'm like, no, I don't want it. It was like the Iron Man conversation. I was like, no way. I was like, I got a good thing going on with Less Doing, and Anna's pregnant with our fourth. We're going on vacation next week. And he said, well, what if we do it together? And I was like, okay, let's do it. But we got to launch quick. So we launched like a day later. with one VA and 10 clients from the mastermind, and grew very, very, very rapidly from there. We did $1 million in revenue our first year. We had 183 people working for us in 17 time zones. Somewhere around the 22nd month or so of the company, I decided that I wanted Nick to buy me out, and I left. That was about 7 months ago.
And what prompted that decision?
So I think it was something that was building for a long time, and I don't want this to come off in any way like I'm putting either of us on different levels. All right, we're just Nick and I are very different in some ways. Nick is very, very analytical, and I'm a lot more sort of like fly by the seat of your pants, which, you know, both sides have pros and cons. At the end of the day, he and I had very different visions for the company. So nothing wrong with his vision, and I don't think anything wrong with mine, but they were different. And it's kind of like being in a marriage and deciding that you want to raise your kids in different religions. Like, it's a very hard thing to reconcile that I think a lot of founders don't look at. One of the ways that we found that out was we did this exercise called the Vivid Vision, which is created by Cameron Harold. And we probably should have done it a lot sooner. And it's something that I actually recommend a lot of founders do very early. But essentially, sometime in the summer, we really did this exercise and we found out that Nick had a vision for a much, much larger company. And I had a vision for a significantly smaller company with a more of a focus on consulting and higher level stuff. And Nick was looking at us more as like the Uber for virtual assistants, which, again, both are fine, but they're so far apart that it was really hard for us to kind of meet in the middle. And it's one of those things. It's not just like, oh, it's a vision on the wall and, you know, we look at it and every now and then. No, it really drives the decisions that you make in the business and the things that you want to do. So it just created tension and frustration, I think, on both sides. And on October, I think, 14th or whatever it was, we had a meeting with a finance person and our bookkeeper. And I pulled him aside and I was like, look, I really think that you should buy me out. I think you have a really big vision for where this company is going to go, and you should take it there. And I'm going to go back to doing what I love, which is coaching and the consulting. And that was that. And we parted ways. And I relaunched Less Doing about, I guess, 2 or 3 days later, really. And it's been like a rocket ship since then.
That's amazing. Are there any specific lessons or takeaways that you picked up from that breakup? Is there anything that you do differently?
There's huge lessons from it. One of which is, yes, I think that you need like this idea of a vivid vision and getting it clear on paper. If you have a co-founder, that's really, really important. The second one, ego is the enemy. I think we've heard that before. It's the title of a book. Like, ego is the enemy, and understanding that your vision might not be the right one. And I'm talking about myself too. And being able to either work within that confine or not. Now, the thing that it's not so much a lesson, but a big takeaway for me, which I take with me every day, is there's this idea in yoga and also in the, I guess it's the Bhagavad Gita, which is the yoga scripts, about non-attachment. A lot of people said to me, like, how could you spend, you know, 2 years building up this company and making all this money and like having this team and then just walking away from it? I was like, because I'm not the company. I am me, you know, and I'm going to do something else. That idea of non-attachment, I think, is so important. And I don't mean to the extent where people can be like flaky and just like not fulfill responsibilities. You are not your ideas, right? And you are not the company. As much as a company might be your baby, like if you hold on to a sinking ship, that's not going to serve anybody. So at the end of the day, you need to be able to walk away from things. You need to be able to burn things to the ground in order to build up the right thing. So it's not so much a new lesson, but it definitely reinforced that for me. And it's proved to be really good. And the biggest success for me from my experience with Leverage is that I got to work with 600 clients, many of whom I still have relationships with. And I got to run an incredible team of people, a few of whom still work for me in my new venture. So again, the only failure for me is if you don't learn something from it. Now, there's something that I would have done differently. If I had it all to do over again, first of all, I would have done the vision earlier. The second thing is that I probably would have brought in an actual CEO earlier as well. So part of the divide that happened was that sometime in the summer, we were having sort of loggerheads and frustration. And I went to Cameron and I said, you know, I think that we need a CEO. I was like, I think we got a really good company here. And I think we need a CEO that can sort of be that driver of the ship. And Nick can focus on tech and I can focus on people, on sales and marketing. And Cameron's response to that was, why don't you be the CEO? And I said, I don't want to be the CEO. I think you need somebody. And through, you know, conversation, that never ended up happening. But I think that going back, if we had done that, things might have gone very differently. And it would have allowed us to sort of step out of those roles and remove the ego from that equation. The other thing that I think I would have probably done differently is a big problem that we had, which we did something that most companies do wrong. We did it right to a point, and then we stopped doing it right. And what I'm referring to is investment in tech. So a lot of companies will raise a lot of money, spend years of time developing, you know, the perfect website or the perfect app, and then release it to an audience that doesn't actually want it. Whereas what we did was we had absolute proof of product market fit right away. We were profitable from day one, and we spent several months building software to help us run the company better. And we were able to build it in a way that it actually served the needs of our clients and of our team. And what we ended up with was pretty clunky and pretty buggy, but it worked and it was great. But then at some point, there was decisions made to invest heavily in a really nice, squeaky, polished tech solution. Unfortunately, the person that we chose to do it ended up being very unreliable and never delivered anything while taking an enormous amount of money. And that not only was a financial issue, but it was just became a huge sort of emotional issue in the company.
Yeah, those are all really important lessons. I mean, I love what you said about not holding on to a sinking ship. There's a quote from, I think it's from Upton Sinclair, where he says, it's very hard to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. When you're so attached to a business or an idea, it becomes really hard to move on from it. And so that non-attachment is really, really important. I want to go back to something you said that's come up now twice. So you'd mentioned early on when you were growing up that you had never really had your ideas challenged before. Correct me if I'm wrong. You also said, you might have said that that still sometimes comes up as an issue for you. And it relates to this ego is the enemy idea as well. Today, how do you deal with that aspect? Because I do this as well. I tend to initially at least get defensive when someone challenges me. So do you have any specific strategies that you use or self-talk to accept challenges as sort of positive challenges as opposed to getting defensive about them?
Yeah. So, and it's not easy, and I'm far from perfect. So there's a book called Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink, which is, he's a former Navy SEAL, and it's almost a little bit too much, but it is this idea. It's like there's no bad team. There's only bad leaders. And that there's this old idea of owning everything and seeking accountability to try to improve it. And there's that side of it, which has its place. But yes, I do try to have some element of self-talk. And the first thing I try to say to myself is, are they right? Which is not always easy. And, you know, and then you say, okay, well, they are right. You know, I did do that thing, or that thing did happen. Now, what do we do about it? I tend to be very solution oriented, which, you know, in some cases, some people just want to be heard. That's always a little bit harder for me to reconcile. But I try my best. I think I'm actually pretty good about it in business situations now. I'm less competent with it when it comes to relationships, like my wife and friendships and things. But I'm working on that. But really just telling myself, like, are they right? Because if they're right, then, okay, well, then I don't really have an argument. I have to figure out something that we can do to improve it and make it better.
We're almost at time here, Ari, and I always like to ask my guests at the end of the interview if they have any parting words on failure that they'd like to share with the audience.
As I said, I think that the only failure is having experience and not learning from it. So going back and doing the same mistake over and over, that's the failure in my mind. And the other thing is being afraid of failure. And we can't be afraid of failure. I think that there's been dozens, if not hundreds, of failures in my life, most of them probably very small, that have informed the decisions that I make and how I do the things that I do. So don't avoid failure. Don't seek failure necessarily either, but don't avoid failure. Because if you get into a situation where things don't go the way you want them to go, but you remain agile, then you can change direction. So in that way, being decisive is one of the most important things I think you can do, and always moving forward. Because even if you make a decision and it's the wrong one, at least you're now in a new position to make a new decision with new information and hopefully get it right.
So where can people find more about Less Doing and everything you're doing now?
So we have a brand new, almost complete website at lessdoing.com where everything lives. The blog's there, the podcast. They can find out about the Facebook group, the Less Doing Labs, my books, and all of our programs and everything else is there at lessdoing.com. And I'm on social media as at Ari Mizell for the most part.
Excellent. Ari, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.